I just got the news that my baby wants to rock. All she wants to do is rock.
Welcome to the second of a five-part series on King Records, produced for September 2016's King Records Celebration in Cincinnati. I'm Lee Hay. During this hour, you'll hear two interviews about Wynonie Harris, conducted by music historian Brian Powers.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Elwood Blues. I'm in the Queen City, Cincinnati, Ohio, laying low and getting some repairs done on the Bluesmobile. While I am here, I wanted to tell you about a guy who recorded in this city some of the most important jump blues of the post-war era. I'm talking about the legendary Wynonie Harris, Mr. Blues, who scored 15 top 10 hits on the rhythm and blues charts between 1946 and 1952. He was recognized as a rock and roll forerunner, the guy who showed Elvis how to move that pelvis. Tonight, our host Lee Hay will play Wynonie music, and we will learn more about this important performer from his son Wesley and his biographer Tony Collins. Stay with us.
My name is Wesley Devereaux. I'm Wynonie Harris's only son. 82 years old, still kicking. He did have an older daughter.
Well, can you give me a little bit of background on your father? Like, where did he grow up? And maybe a little bit about, was he an only child? Did he have brothers and sisters, that kind of thing?
Well, Wynonie was definitely an only child. And he grew up here in Omaha. I guess he was born here. His mother was from Alabama. And he went to school here. He lived here all his life. I guess that's where his career started, right here in Omaha. But there's very few people that know about him right here in his own hometown where he grew up.
Did he grow up in a one-parent home? Did his mom or grandmom raise him or something?
More than likely, he grew up with just his mother. His dad and his mother probably separated because his dad was in and out of Omaha all the time. He had some kind of job where he followed the races, and we had a racetrack here called Exarban, which is Nebraska. Spelt backwards. So he was in and out here all the time.
He had other children other than you, right? He had a daughter?
But he only had two kids. I had an older sister, Mickey. Her real name was Vivian, but she went by Mickey all her life. He had a stepdaughter by his first wife.
Well, do you know how your father got exposed to music?
I know he started right here in Omaha. At one time, this was a stopping off place for a lot of musicians way back in the day. A lot of the top musicians came through here. That's how he got exposed to it.
So what kind of scene was going on there? Were there a lot of venues for musicians to play at, I guess?
Everybody that was anybody that came through here played at the Dreamland Ballroom. And it's still there today. And there was a place on the corner of 24th and Lake called the Blue Room. Those were the two main places where all the musicians came to. If you were black and you were anybody, you either came to the Dreamland or you came to the Blue Room.
Now, I had read that Wynonie Harris had started out as a dancer.
Yes, he was one heck of a dancer. He was really, really a performer. As a matter of fact, if you read his book, back in the back, there was a time when he used to play in a stage show in Memphis, Tennessee. And when Elvis was a kid, they would let Elvis in the back door and watch him perform on the stage. And he was really excited about the way he performed.
Yeah, I always heard that's where Elvis got his moves, was from Wynonie Harris.
He copied Wynonie and Jackie Wilson. If you ever seen that movie, Jailhouse Rock, most of the moves in that movie came from Jackie Wilson and Wynonie.
So you grew up in Omaha, but I guess your father had moved on to, like, maybe L.A., but I guess you would have been a teenager when he started getting pretty big. How many memories do you have of that?
I remember when I was about 13 or 14. He came through Omaha at a nightclub called the Anvets, and he took me to the nightclub that night, and he showed me off. I used to bang on a piano a little bit. He brought me up on the stage and had me play a song, and the band followed me, and boy, you're talking about something, a good feeling. I felt great. That was the first time I ever faced an audience of any kind.
So you saw your dad perform. Can you describe, give us a picture of what that was like?
He put on a show for you. The one time I really saw him perform when I was an adult was at the Apollo Theater back in 1955, I think it was. And I was living with him at the time. And that was really an exciting thing to see him at the Apollo Theater.
So how would he dress?
Well, he was a sharp dresser. I think I inherited that from him. But when he went to New York, he dressed in Western attire. He wore a big old cowboy hat and cowboy boots. Well, you didn't notice too many black people back in his day that wore cowboy hats and wore cowboy boots, put it that way.
You were talking about he was a pretty sharp dresser other than his country outfits. Was he always dressed sharp?
Yeah. Yes, he was. It was all part of the show. You know, he's a showman. He got your attention. He came to Omaha once when I was really young. He was driving a white Cadillac convertible with leopard skin, I think, upholstery. He's a 1948 or a 1949 Cadillac. I can see him driving down the main street in Omaha, driving that car.
Now, he had a house there in that neighborhood. There was a lot of jazz guys who lived in that neighborhood.
Yeah. Right? He lived right next door to Arthur Prysock. About two houses down the street was where Count Basie lived. And the Mills Brothers lived close to there, too. I think the house was in Long Island. I got a picture of it. I lived with him there for 6 months.
I always read about how he was kind of this wild, crazy character, and I was wondering, can you comment on that?
That's what I heard, too. I don't think he had very much respect for women, to be truthful. They were things to be used by him. Because my sister went up there in New York, and she stayed with him. I think she told me 6 or 7 months, long before I did, and she said she couldn't stay there. She couldn't handle him. My understanding is the only person he could really deal with was his mother. And when she passed, nobody could deal with him.
Did he eat much? I mean, was he much particular with his eating habits, or did he drink certain drinks or anything?
As a matter of fact, I can't even remember seeing him sitting down eating a meal. One thing he told me, he says, Wes, he says, I drink a lot. But he said, let me tell you something else. He said, it's all right for you to drink, but don't you mess with no kind of dope. He said, stay away from the dope.
Well, I know he sang about whiskey a lot. Did he actually drink whiskey?
Everything was about whiskey. About everything he did was about whiskey. You know, everybody has something they sing about. Love songs, hate songs, whatever. But all his recordings are mostly about whiskey.
And did he actually drink whiskey?
He drank White Horse Scotch.
Whiskey, whiskey on the shelf. You were so quiet there by yourself. Things were fine till they took you down and opened you up and passed you around. John was the first one to pull you down. He took one drink and he started to clown. Passed you to Hazel, Jane, and Jack. Penelope got you and passed you right back. The doorbell rang and what did you see? In walked Henry, Fred, and Marie. They hit you high, they hit you low. They hit you fast and they hit you slow. Whiskey on the shelf. You were so quiet there by yourself. Things were fine till they took you down, opened you up and passed you around.
Well, I was wondering, you were in a group.
It started in high school. There were there was five guys. We all went to the same high school, and we all graduated from the same high school. The most noticeable one you would remember that became famous was Gene McDaniels, 100 Pounds of Clay. Well, he sung 100 Pounds of Clay. He didn't write it, but it was the biggest hit. And then he wrote Feel Like Making Love, which was recorded over 200 times by different artists. The group was called the Sultans, and we recorded for Duke Records, which was a subsidiary of Peacock.
How did you guys get signed to Duke?
After we got out of school, there was a guy who owned a bar right behind the Blue Room. It was called Allen's Showcase, and he was interested in music, and he heard us sing once at another nightclub, and he took us under his wing and became our manager. And we ended up in Columbus, Ohio. And we were singing in a nightclub, and Wynonie was singing in a nightclub in Cleveland. And word got to him that his son was in Columbus. So he had driven from New York to Cleveland. And two of the guys went up to Cleveland. And I stayed in Columbus because I was dating Nancy Wilson at the time. So I wasn't going nowhere. And they brought the car back that he told us to drive to New York, and he'd see what he could do for us up in New York. So that's how come I ended up in New York with him. That was 1955.
Now, didn't he introduce you to Henry Glover?
Yeah. Henry Glover wrote for King Records. He was the one that got us the recording date under the Admirals. But we were still under contract to Duke Records. But King Records had another singing group that was under contract called The Admirals. The group had broken up. So we tried to cover a song that the Five Keys cut a song in California called Close Your Eyes. And we tried to cover it and get it out ahead of them in New York. But we were a little bit too late. You know, they had a hit with it, but we waited a little bit too late. But they did release it, and I sung the lead on it because they didn't want to recognize it. Tried not to recognize the other lead singer, which was Willie Barnes. But then Duke Records got wind of it, so they wouldn't renew our contract with Duke. And Duke was on the downside after that anyway. After they lost Johnny Ace and Bobby Bland went somewhere else, that was about the end of Peacock Records.
And you guys did some background singing for some King artists when you were in New York, didn't you?
Yeah, Lucky Millinder, Bubba Johnson, and Kathy Ryan. And that was with the Lucky Millinder band.
And what became of the group after you came back from New York?
Well, the one guy joined the Navy, and we tried to place him a couple times with a couple of guys that didn't work out. Then Gene McDaniels took off and went to California. We tried to replace him. And then Roy Hamilton came here, and he heard the group singing, the replacement group, and he heard our lead singer, one of our lead singers, Willie Barnes, and he offered Willie Barnes to take him to New York and get him a recording contract. And I guess that was about the end of the group.
Do you have much memories of Henry Glover in the studio?
I think I was only in the studio with Henry about twice. He wrote a song for us called Oh Yes. I recorded it. I'd almost completely forgot about it 2 years later. We put it on the back side of that Close Your Eyes. At that time at King Records, he was their main writer, I think, at the time.
Your father at that time, around 55, what was going on with his career?
It was on the downside, really. I can't tell you the reason why. He couldn't get work anymore.
Well, I guess his style of music was kind of changing, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, he became known as a blues shouter. His voice was rough and kind of ragged, even when he was at his peak.
Now, I had read somewhere that he owned a bar.
Yeah, that was in a town called Far Rockaway. He was in partners with Sonny Pepitone. Now, he claimed that Sonny had mafia ties, but I never saw it. But we helped him get the bar in shape. We cleaned it up and painted it, but it never opened. At least it didn't open while I was there. And I think it never got off the ground.
Was he able to still get gigs?
That was the problem. He couldn't get gigs anymore.
What was he doing when he wasn't singing? Did you keep in touch with him much?
Well, you know, I only stayed with him for 6 months, from about around the 1st of January, 1955, to the middle of 55. After that, we lost contact. The next contact I had heard about him was somebody called me that knew him that lived in California, that he had died. So I got a hold of somebody that knew where he was in California, and I called him. And he said, no, Wes, he said, I didn't die, but somebody else that went out there the same time he did. He told me he had throat cancer. He says, I'm taking treatment. He said, don't worry about me. He said, because I'm just fine. Then about 2 weeks later, I got another call, and this time they said he had died.
Did you make it to his memorial or his funeral?
Oh, no. It was over before I even found out about it.
Is he buried anywhere, or did he get cremated?
I got his death certificate here. He's buried at Woodland Cemetery in L.A.
I'm Tony Collins. I became a big Wynonie Harris fan in the 1970s. My interest in him was such that I eventually wrote a book on him that was published under the title Rock Mr. Blues in 1995 by Big Nickel Publications. Unfortunately, the book is no longer in print, but it was, from my point of view, it was very worthwhile doing it, and I thoroughly enjoyed all the time I spent researching Wynonie. As far as how I get interested in Wynonie, I didn't discover Wynonie's music until 1972. I became, like many people of the early baby boomers in the UK, I became interested in blues in the 1960s. The interest in blues in the 1960s was centered pretty much exclusively on down-home blues, electric blues guys like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Elmore James and John Lee Hooker and Slim Harpo and the occasional acoustic guy like Fred McDowell. Those were the songs that the British beat groups were influenced by, and those were the artists that I discovered at that time. The early rhythm and blues of people like Wynonie Harris was not mentioned at all. Not until 1972, when I actually bought a record with Wynonie on. The record I bought was called Jump Blues. It was issued in the UK on the Polydor label, and the Polydor had at that time a deal to issue records that had been made for King Records, and it had Wynonie Harris on one side and Eddie Cleanhead Vincent on the other. Well, I loved the whole record, but it was Wynonie's side that had the bigger impact on me, and I just loved his voice from the moment I heard it. And it also connected with me because when I'd been very small, I was aware of rock and roll, Elvis Presley, Little Richard, and then later in the 60s in Chuck Berry and what have you. And when I heard Wynonie Harris, he was a blues singer, but at the same time, it was clearly very close to the rock and roll that I was also familiar with. So it kind of tied things together in a certain way and helped me understand how the different types of music were connected.
You didn't write your book until the 80s, or no, into
That's
the 90s.
Right.
So what's your story and how you eventually came around to writing a book? How did you go about your research?
Well, I think what prompted me to write it was that it was clear that Wynonie Harris had been a big star in his day, and yet almost nothing was known about him. In fact, the sleeve notes to that first LP that I bought said he was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I've no idea where that information came from, but it was completely wrong because he grew up in Omaha, Nebraska. So I thought how strange it was that a man who'd been such a big star was now virtually unknown. By the time I discovered Wynonie had died. He died in 1969 of throat cancer. So anyway, so this was, I suppose, lurking in the back of my mind for a long time. And in the late 70s and early 80s, more attention began to be focused on those early rhythm and blues singers. There were more reissues that were coming out as people who'd started loving down-home blues began to expand the areas of blues that they were interested in. And in Sweden, a guy who called himself Mr. R&B, Jonas Bernholm, and he began putting out reissues of old R&B records. He had a huge collection of old 78s. They were dubbed from the old 78s, but he always contacted, if the artist was alive, he made sure he contacted the artist and paid the artist royalties. So the artist was involved in all stages. So it was very much to assist these guys, and often he arranged for them to go to Sweden and perform there. Certainly in many cases that happened. So I think it was about 1977 he put out a Wynonie Harris LP. There was still very little Wynonie Harris music available at that time. And in 1980 he put out a second one. And the second one had sleeve notes by a man called Preston Love, who was a musician, an alto sax player, whose career began in the early 40s. He'd played with Count Basie, among other people, but he also grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and was a lifelong friend of Wynonie Harris. So I decided that I would write to Jonas Bernholm and ask him if he could let me have an address for Preston Love. So I did that, and I got a reply very quickly. I then wrote to Preston Love, explained that I was really interested in Wynonie Harris. Anyway, I got a reply back very quickly, and the reply was so encouraging and enthusiastic at the idea that there was this guy in England who liked Wynonie Harris that I felt I wanted to take this further. Now, it was in 1988, 1968, I think, that it so happened that Preston Love came to the UK to play at the Birmingham Jazz and Blues Festival. We basically hung out together the whole time. Birmingham is the town I grew up in. And Preston felt, rightly or wrongly, that I'd been in some way responsible for him appearing there. I had. So anyway, we got to know each other then, and Preston invited me to stay with him and his wife in Omaha, which I did. So I spent about a week in Omaha in the summer of 1988. Preston knew Wynonie's daughter, Mickey, who was living in Omaha. He knew Wynonie's son, Wesley, who lived in Omaha. So he was able to introduce me to these people and other people. So that was really the beginning. And I'd already arranged that after Omaha, I would go to the West Coast and do what research I could there. So I was in Los Angeles for a week. When I came back, I had so much useful information in the form of interviews that I thought, well, I just have to write that book now. So that's what I did. And I ended up going back to the States twice more. I went to New York in 1989 and then back to Omaha again in 1991. And eventually, the book came out in 1995.
Were you able to find, other than family members, were you able to talk to other people who knew Wynonie Harris?
I talked to a lot of people who knew Wynonie. I talked to Velda Shannon, who was his dancing partner when Wynonie started in show business in the early 1930s in Omaha. She was living in Los Angeles, and Preston Love had a telephone number for her. Through Velda Shannon, I was able to speak to Ollie, who was Wynonie's first wife. And then I was also able to find quite a few musicians who'd known him. Wynonie had been based on the West Coast from 1939 until 1944, and then again from 1963 until 1969. And Wynonie was one of those people. Anyone who met him never forgot it. He was just a larger-than-life character. So everyone had some memory of Wynonie. And for most people, it was a happy memory. You'd mention the name and a smile would cross people's lips at the memory of him.
Well, can you tell us a little bit what you found out about his childhood, like about his parents and how he got into music or something?
Well, in fact, since I wrote the book, there's been more research done. What we do know is his surname comes from Luther Harris, who was his mother's second husband. Now, At the time, I thought that was her first husband and that Wynonie was illegitimate, but that is not the case. His father was a man named Hood, and I don't know the first name, and his stepfather was Luther Harris, and Wynonie took the surname of his stepfather. Whether he was born in Omaha is open to doubt. According to the 1920 census, he was born in Iowa. Now, Council Bluffs, Iowa, is just across the river from Omaha. But anyway, Wynonie certainly grew up in Omaha and went to school in Omaha. And when he left school, as far as I can see, he went straight into show business as a dancer with this lady, Velda Shannon.
How did he get into show business?
The black part of Omaha had its entertainment district in the center that had several bars and a ballroom and a theater. So eventually, Wynonie and Velda were working at a place called Jim Bell's Harlem Club that was quite a large and, you know, well-appointed nightclub that was slap bang in the center of the entertainment district. And it seems to be there, so far as one can gather, that he began to sing as well.
When did he sort of become known as a singer?
Well, he was still in Omaha. I think from about 1935, 36 onwards, he was primarily a singer and became a big name in Omaha. In 1939, he decided to move to Los Angeles. Certainly, he would have thought that there would be more opportunities in Los Angeles, and there was a big entertainment scene centered on Central Avenue.
Now, eventually, he joins up with a guy named Lucky Millinder.
That's right. He was a big enough name in Los Angeles that he was getting bookings outside of Los Angeles as well as in Los Angeles. So his reputation was spreading by word of mouth. There were no records being made at that time because of a strike by the American Federation of Musicians. In addition, there was the materials for making 78s, which was what records were in those days, 78 RPM records, they were made of shellac, and that was needed for the war effort. So there was no recording industry at the time. So anyway, his reputation was spreading by word of mouth. This was one of the nicest surprises I had when I was doing my research, when I found out exactly where and when he joined Lucky Millinder. He had a week's residency at a club in Chicago, the last week of March 1944. And it so happened that Lucky Millinder's band was also in Chicago that week. And Lucky Millinder had a problem because his singer, Trevor Bacon, had given notice to quit the band because he'd had a record that was popular and he decided to leave and go out on his own. And Lucky Millinder needed a replacement. So Lucky Millinder came to see Wynonie and offered him, you know, a place in the band. And Wynonie said yes. And within 2 or 3 weeks, they were back in New York, which was Lucky Millinder's base. And by May or June, they were in the recording studio. Wynonie sang the vocals on two numbers at the session, 26th of May. And they both sold well. And Who Threw the Whiskey in the Well was a really big hit. And that was the following year. Because by that time, even without that record coming out, Wynonie was just better known because he was touring with Lucky Millinder. So within 6 months, Wynonie had left the band.
Did you ever find some research on why he decided to go solo or why he left Lucky Millinder's band?
I asked Preston Love this because Preston Love, as it happens, was in Lucky Millinder's band at that time. And Preston Love told me that Wynonie asked for a pay rise and Lucky Millinder wouldn't give him one, so Wynonie left. The record industry really picked up in 1945. So it was 1945. Who Threw the Whiskey in the Well wasn't actually released until 1945. So when that came out, and that was a big hit, then Wynonie was hot property. And he did lots of recording in 1945 and 1946 for several different record companies. One is Around the Clock Blues, first recording he made as a solo artist. Despite the title, it doesn't really have anything to do with rock around the clock. But it's a song that Wynonie was singing in the clubs and was, as far as I can make out, a highlight of his act in the early 40s. It's based on an old blues record by a singer named Clara Smith, but in Wynonie's hands it sounds much more modern. Several other singers also recorded it. And lyrically, it's a precursor to Chuck Berry's Reelin' and Rockin'.
Yes, and sometimes I think I won't. Sometimes I think I will. Yes, and sometimes I think I won't. Sometimes I believe I do, and then again I believe I don't. Well, looked at the clock. The clock struck one. She said, come on, Daddy, let's have a little more fun. Yes, we've been rolling. Yes, we've rolled a long time. She said, I'm so glad I'm living. I said, ooh, we are sure glad you're mine. Well, we looked at the clock.
The other record I picked as one to play is a record called Here Comes the Blues. And I picked that because it's a straight, slow 12-bar blues. Wynonie didn't record too many of those, at least not when he was on King he didn't. He recorded more of them before then. Here Comes the Blues, I just think, is a superlative performance from start to finish. It's very much in the idiom of the day, which is kind of where jazz and blues meet, and it starts with a very long tenor sax solo by Illinois Jacket, and then Wynonie takes over for the rest of the record. It shows that Wynonie could do more than just belt out up-tempo humorous songs. He could really sing a slow blues with feeling.
your door. Here comes the blues. Please open up your door. And when I leave you this time, baby, I won't be back no more. Never let a woman know you love her. Yes, that's what I've been told. Yes, that's what I've been told. But every time I look at you, baby, you make my blood run cold.
And in 1945, he was in his early 30s, so his voice was still in its prime. And it's just a gorgeous performance.
When was that recorded or released, and what label was that on?
Yeah, that was recorded in 1945 for Apollo Records.
Would you know what labels he recorded from between when he recorded those songs with Lucky Millinger to when he got signed to King Records?
Sure. He recorded for Philo. That was the label that he recorded Around the Clock Blues on. And then he recorded for Apollo. He recorded for Hamptone, which is owned by Lionel Hampton or Lionel Hampton's wife. He recorded for Bullet Records, which is based down in Nashville. And he recorded for Aladdin.
So in 1947, Sid Nathan, King Records here in Cincinnati, going to try to go sign Whiny Harris. Can you tell us a little bit about what you remember about that story? Or
about 15 or 20 years ago, there was a nice box set of King Rhythm and Blues issued, a 4-CD box set. And on the 4th CD were a couple of examples of Sid Nathan, who was boss of King Records, giving a talk to his sales staff. And in one of them, he talks about the time that he went to sign Wynonie Harris. King Records started off recording country music, or hillbilly music, to use the terminology of the day. And it was only in about 1943, I think. And so it was a few years later when Sid Nathan decided to get into rhythm and blues. Having signed Bill Moose Jackson and realized that he could sell R&B records too, of course they weren't called R&B records then, they were still called Race Records, which was the pre-war terminology. In 1947, he decided to get into rhythm and blues in a big way and decided to sign some established stars. Ivory Joe Hunter was one, and Wynonie was another.
Now we later got to a point where we felt that we knew what we were doing in the race business. And I said, within 3 months, I'm going to get new artists and make a push for the race field. We had carried over from the Queen label one good artist, Moose Jackson. And please don't refer to him as Bull Moose. He looks like a bull, but he sings too pretty to have the name Bull on the end of his name. It's a classy name. Now, immediately, I think Mr. Kessel had the pleasure of being with me the night that we contacted the great Mr. Blues Wynonie Harris in a backstreet, dingy hotel in Harlem. And when we knocked on the door, he says, come in, and there were three gals in the room with him.
How were they?
Nigga. So one of them opened her mouth, and he threw her out in the hall without any clothes on. Is that right, Mr. Kessel?
He was laying in bed with a pair of pink satin underpants.
So that gives you some idea of Wynonie. So they spent all night talking to him, and by the following morning, he was a King recording artist.
He did his first sessions in Cincinnati for King in December of 47. Out of that session was Good Rockin' Tonight.
Well, the first recordings were actually made in New York.
Oh, right.
Which didn't go particularly well. there seems to have been friction between Wynonie and the band. So then they tried again in Cincinnati. They recorded Good Rockin' Tonight. Record companies were stockpiling recordings at the time because there was another American Federation of Musicians strike about to start on the 1st of January. So they just had until the 31st of December to stockpile as much as they could to see them through and until the point at which the strike might end, whenever that would be. So Good Rockin' Tonight was actually recorded on the 28th of December. That was already his fourth recording session. He'd done four recording sessions in effectively the second half of December. Because Good Rockin' Tonight was the one that became the big hit.
Hey, I'm Elwood Blues. I want to introduce you to one of my favorite Wynonie Harris tunes. It was written by the great Roy Brown. It was recorded in December 1947 in the accounting offices of King Records at 1540 Brewster, right here in Cincinnati. It went to number one on the R&B charts in 1948, paving the way for things to come. Have you heard the news? There's Good Rockin' Tonight.
Away all my blues. Have you heard the news? They're good at rockin' tonight. Rock on, rock.
Do you know much about who were the musicians playing on those sessions?
It was a band led by the trumpeter Hot Lips Page. So it was his band. Hot Lips Page was the trumpeter. The tenor sax player, who plays a very important role, is Hal Singer, who went on to have a hit in later years under his own name with an instrumental called Cornbread. I can give you the names of the other guys in the band. They're not so well known. Joe Knight on piano, Carl Flattop Wilson on bass, and Clarence Donaldson on drums.
Good Rockin' Tonight, people know that as an Elvis song, but how big of a hit was it for Wynonie Harris?
Well, Wynonie had been offered that song earlier. I'm not sure exactly when, by the guy who wrote it, who was Roy Brown. This is when Roy Brown hadn't yet made any records, so he wanted someone to record his song. And Wynonie brushed him off and said, "Don't bother me." And then when Roy Brown did get a chance to record and record Good Rockin' Tonight, then Wynonie did record Good Rockin' Tonight. As Roy Brown said, "Well, I wanted him to record it, he didn't. And when I didn't want him to record it, he did." But Wynonie had the bigger hit, had a much bigger hit. Wynonie's was number one on the rhythm and blues charts for a number of weeks. It was a really big hit.
What did he bring to his version different from Roy Brown's version?
My immediate reaction, what Wynonie brought to it, was the fact that he was Wynonie. But there's definitely more to it than that. I played both of those records about an hour ago, and they do sound quite different. The Roy Brown has more of a swing rhythm. The Wynonie Harris is a more punchier record all round. The Wynonie Harris record starts with this tenor sax that leaps right out to the speakers, and then Wynonie sings it with, it seems to me, much more confidence. There's a heavier beat to it. Listening to it now, it strikes one as a much more modern record than the Roy Brown record. Of course, I like Roy Brown a lot. I've got plenty of Roy Brown records. I was lucky enough to see Roy Brown perform live in the late 70s and early 80s. But there's no question that I love Wynonie Harris's singing more. So I'm possibly biased, but it seems to me that both the band and the singing and the arrangement are stronger on the Wynonie Harris record. And of course, Wynonie had the advantage of recording for King, which was pretty well established, good distribution. Roy Brown was recording for Deluxe, which was later bought up by King, but at that time Deluxe was still independent and didn't have the distribution that King Records did. So that would be another reason for the Wynonie Harris to sell better. But it seems to me, even if they'd had an equal chance, it seems to me that the Wynonie Harris record would have been a bigger hit.
Now, some people argue that Good Rockin' Tonight by Wynonie Harris is an early rock and roll song. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, that's not a question that ever concerns me. The record is the record. Even if nobody had recorded it afterwards, it would still be a great record just for what it is. Now, of course, as it happens, lots of people recorded it. Even before Elvis recorded it, there were other R&B singers who recorded it. And once Elvis had recorded it, then so many others did. And therefore, the song became a staple of rock and roll and popular music generally. I have a book called What Was the First Rock and Roll Record by Jim Dawson and Steve Propes that was published in the early 90s. Now, what the book actually is discussion of 50 recordings made between 1945 and 1956. Between them chart the evolution of music from effectively the jazz of the mid-40s to the rock and roll of Elvis Presley. The last one on the list is Heartbreak Hotel. They have Good Rockin' Tonight as one of the 50, which I suppose anyone would. If you were putting together a book that covered that, you would have to include Good Rockin' Tonight. From a personal point of view, of course, if rock and roll hadn't grown out of rhythm and blues, then when I had first heard Wynonie, I wouldn't have had that immediate connection to his music.
Do you have any idea of what Wynonie Harris was as a stage performer?
Unfortunately, there is no surviving footage that anyone is aware of anyway, certainly no surviving footage that's ever surfaced of Wynonie on stage. And it would appear that he moved around on stage somewhat, but exactly what he did, I don't know. What influence he may or may not have had on Elvis, I have no idea.
Well, I was wondering in your research, how big was he? Was he mostly to the black audience? Did he have much of white people listening to music or seeing him?
Well, at that time, music was just about as segregated as the rest of American life. I mean, all records were issued and marketed to specific groups. So records by black artists were marketed to black people. I mean, the only exceptions were some of the big bands which sold to a white audience, and maybe an artist like Nat King Cole, and Louis Jordan as well, who was so big that he crossed over, if you like, to a white audience. But everybody else was confined to the R&B market, which was strictly where records were bought by African Americans. I mean, there wasn't a radio station that devoted to playing black music until 1950, I think it was, when WDIA started in Memphis. Most R&B records that were made ended up on jukeboxes. That was where the sales were.
What do you think about the jump blues genre? I mean, people don't seem to be familiar with it.
Without jump blues, there wouldn't have been rock and roll. Rock and roll essentially was jump blues, except that it was marketed to a different audience. Rock and roll is essentially, as it seems to me, a marketing term, which means that the music could be sold to teenagers, which meant effectively, for the most part, white teenagers, which meant that the records obviously couldn't discuss sex or alcohol. Those subjects were taboo. They were about school and cars and crushes.
Do you know what kind of venues he was playing at?
He would have weekly residences in nightclubs in the big cities that had black populations, Chicago, Baltimore. There was a circuit of black theaters that all the big R&B stars played, like the Apollo in Harlem. There was one in Washington, D.C., and there was one in Atlanta. So there was a circuit of black theaters. There were black clubs in the big cities. that was the staple, a week's residency at one of those. And then in the early 50s, you start to get, actually before then as well, there'd be tours, he'd go on tours where of one-nighters, where you were in a different town every night. Those developed, as far as I can gather, those developed more and more in the 50s and gave rise to the rock and roll package tours of the late 1950s. I know of a couple of tours like that that Wynonie did in the 50s, one where he was a co-star with Larry Darnell. Another one from 1953, where he was on a bill that was quite a large bill, and there's six or seven acts on the bill, the Great Rhythm and Blues Show of 1953, that had Ruth Brown, the Buddy Johnson Band, Wynonie, and various other people.
Did you get a sense of how much money he was making?
For the most part, no. I think Preston Love told me that when he joined Lucky Millinder, he was getting $125 a week or something, which I suppose was very big money for the day. I think for a lot of rhythm and blues stars in the 50s, they didn't know how much money they were making. Wynonie had a manager to look after his business affairs called Jimmy Evans, who was based in New York. This was after he moved to New York. Previously, he'd had a manager on the West Coast. I don't suppose Wynonie was that assiduous about looking after the financial side of what he did. I imagine that's true for a lot of people in show business even today. And certainly in the 50s, black artists had often a kind of paternal attitude towards black artists. They needed something. If they needed a new car, someone bought it for them. The manager bought it for them, or the record company bought it for them. And they never knew exactly how much money who owed whom.
Do you hear much stories about his spending habits or anything? Or?
Well, he would have spent money on clothes, because if you're appearing on stage, you need to look good. You need to look the part. And I imagine that he had a new car probably every year when he was at the height of his popularity. I mean, there is a story, and I don't know if it's true or not. I can't remember even offhand who told this story, but there is a story of him and Roy Brown sort of wrecking each other's cars or whatever, just to show that they could afford to.
And he bought a house in New York City, right?
He did. He bought a house in a very nice neighborhood where a lot of black showbiz people lived, in St. Albans in Queens. I did get to visit the house when I went to New York in 1989. I didn't have the courage to knock on the door. I just contented myself with a photo of it. And Wynonie's daughter, Patty, had a photo of it that had been taken in the 1950s that I took a copy of. So he lived there from around about 1950 or 51 until he lost the house sometime in the late 50s.
He seems to have this wild reputation of, you know, whiskey drinking and cars. Does that ring true with you talking to people who knew him?
Very much so. He was certainly a ladies' man, that's for sure. Preston Love told me a story that if Wynonie saw a girl he liked, he'd rip a $50 bill in two and give her one half and say, yeah, meet me tonight at so-and-so and I'll have the other half of the $50 bill for you. So, yes, he was a ladies' man, as they say. And, of course, he was good-looking. And he had very striking grey, sort of bluey-grey eyes, which is quite unusual in a black man. So they would have made him stand out even more.
A lot of his songs, he talks about whiskey. Was it much of a drinker?
Yes, he was. He was a drinker. I was told that Johnny Walker Red Label was his whiskey of choice. So he certainly did drink whiskey. Yeah, the songs about alcohol did reflect the life he lived.
Can you talk about some of his other hits that he had for King Records?
Yes. Well, most of his hits were on King Records. And he had, I mean, in his day, he was just about as big a star as you can be. I mean, he had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 hits, I think that is, on King. And hits meant they made the top 10. Two made number one, Good Rockin' Tonight and All She Wants to Do Is Rock. I would say that Wynonie's style changed slightly when he signed for King Records. In a sense, Good Rockin' Tonight was a hint of the change that he would undergo. I suppose the change was partly the fact that music was evolving anyway from the very jazzy music of the late 40s to something with a harder beat and more sharply arranged, more carefully arranged. But increasingly on King Records, there was a lot of humour in the records he made. So, for example, Grandma Plays the Numbers, which recorded in 1948 at the Numbers, as you may know, was an illegal lottery game that operated certainly in the black community. It may well have operated in white communities too, where you'd specify the numbers that you wanted a bet on and hand a slip to a numbers runner, and that would eventually go to the guy who was organising it. And if your numbers came up, then you'd collect the money. A lot of Wynonie's records for King put a smile on your face.
Say, Wynonie, I was by your house last night, and guess what happened? What happened, Mon? Your grandma was playing the numbers.
Well, you just finding that out?
Well, what do you know?
We found out.
Yes, we did.
We found out.
Now we know.
We found out.
We found out that grandma plays the numbers.
We found out.
Yes, we did.
We found out.
She couldn't keep it hid.
We found out.
Now we know.
At King, you know, they had country artists, and he covered some of those artists like Hank Penny and Moon Mulligan.
Yes. It was a frequent ploy by Sid Nathan at King Records to get country artists to record songs that have been hits in the R&B field and to get R&B artists to record songs that have been hits in the country field. Because Sid Nathan knew it had been a hit in one field, it was a good chance it could be a hit in the other. And since a white listener would never have heard the R&B record, probably, and the black listener would never have heard the country record, the song would be new to them. If it was a hit, of course, then King's music publishing company was a winner. The biggest and best example of Wynonie covering a country record would be Bloodshot Eyes, which was recorded by Hank Penny, who was country, or you might call him a Western swing artist. Now, Hank Penny's recording is very nice with an accordion, and it's a pretty swinging record. But Wynonie's sounds completely different with an R&B treatment and a honking sax. And it has great lyrics too. It's, along with Good Rockin' Tonight, probably Wynonie's best known record these days.
Now just because you're pretty and you think you're mighty wise, you tell me that you love me, then you roll those big brown eyes. When I saw you last week, your eyes were turning black. Go find the guy that beat you up. Ask him to take you back. Don't roll those bloodshot eyes at me. I can tell you've been out on a spree. It's plain that you're lying when you say that you've been crying. Don't roll those bloodshot eyes at me.
Eric Burden is on record as saying that when he first heard Bloodshot Eyes by Wynonie Harris, he knew that he wanted to sing like that someday. So it was an influential record too. It was a record that was issued in the UK.
What would you say would be his peak years for his recording career?
Well, the peak would be from 1944 when he joined Lucky Millinder to 1952 when he had his last hit.
We talked to his son a couple of weeks ago. He said when he visited in 55, like, the power went out in the house. Gigs were starting to dry up. And I was wondering, yeah, do you have a theory on what was happening with his career?
Well, I think the main reason is that music evolves and artists go out of fashion. If you look at who the popular R&B artists of, say, 1945, 46, 47 were, by 1954, they're pretty much all no longer having hit records. So what happened to Wynonie was just a sort of reflection of the fact that music changes, and what's hot today is not so hot tomorrow. People are always looking for the next new thing. So I think that is the main reason. I think also that Wynonie perhaps didn't always help himself. Some people found him somewhat, put it this way, he didn't go out of his way to be nice to people, although people who knew him well say how generous he was I think people who didn't know him well could find him somewhat brusque and offhand. So it was possible that that didn't help him. Really, as I say, I think the single biggest reason is that the music was changing so fast, as black music usually does, if all music usually does, but black music especially, it seems to me. And therefore, you're hot now, but you're 5 or 10 years later, you're yesterday's man.
And so after his time with King, he did continue to do some other recording for other labels. Can you tell us a little bit about who else he recorded for later on in the 50s?
He did have a few recording sessions. He had a session for Atco Records, which was a subsidiary of Atlantic Records in New York. Had one session for them, which produced a very nice record called Destination Love. He had a couple of sessions for Roulette Records in New York in 1960. I just had one single issued, although some of the other unreleased tracks did eventually get released on a CD about 20 years ago. That was a remake of Bloodshot Eyes. And in 1963, he recorded for Chess Records. Those sat in the can until they came out on an LP in the early 70s. And they, unlike the Atco and Roulette Records, which were really aimed at the rock and roll market, the things he did for Chess were an attempt to update his sound, make it a little bit different, just to make good music, really, as the way I see it. Put in material that he would be comfortable with, give him some contemporary arrangements. And I think that session works really well. No single was issued at the time. They came out on LP in the 70s, by which time Wynonie was dead. If Wynonie had lived for another 10 years, he would have been asked to come and perform in Europe.
He got sick. Can you tell us a little bit about what was he suffering from?
Yeah, he had throat cancer. He moved back to Los Angeles in 1963. His daughter Patty was living in Los Angeles. And there was a little community of people who emigrated from Omaha in Los Angeles. That's where he spent the final 6 years of his life. And you may know the story that shortly before he died, he organized what he called a going away party and invited all his friends to that. And some of them didn't know that he was ill, so it was only when they turned up that they realized what he meant by his going away party. But he was typical of Wynonie not to complain, just to get on with it. He just wanted to have a good time and be with his friends one last time before he died. Wynonie's daughter Patty showed me a book in which those who attended the funeral had signed their names. There were more than 100 signatures in that book. So he was well loved. But it's clear that he wasn't a rich man when he died, because there's a grave with 4 unrelated people and a headstone with the 4 names.
You've been listening to a King Records special about Wynonie Harris. For more information on September's celebration of King Records in Cincinnati, please visit our website, wvxu.org. Technical support from Andy Balterman, Michael Murphy, and Elwood. Next week, join us for a special about King Records recording artist Roy Brown. I'm Lee Hay.